Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. In primitive pre-Bitcoin societies, tribes would often use something called bonds for savings. For today's episode, our guest is somebody who worked with some of these primitive tribes in their bond markets for more than 30 years. Joining us to share his extensive experience with primitive financial instruments is Greg Foss. Greg, thank you so much for joining us, man.
What a hilarious intro, I have to say. And look, I'm wearing the proper shirt for it as well. I just happen to be wearing my Bitcoin Evolution t-shirt, and you're talking about tribes, probably somewhere around here. This is probably the part of the evolution where people were trading bonds, right? In this, humans just started to walk upright, you know?
Yeah, just after the spear and before Bitcoin. That was the period.
I love it. I love it.
So it's been a pretty momentous weeks and also a couple of years as well in the bond market. We've had you on before. We've discussed this with you. We've discussed also with a lot of the other Bitcoin / bond experts out there. And it's really momentous. I think, you know, somebody was mentioning in an article I was reading that 2022 was the worst year on record for the financial benchmark of the best sovereign debt since 1800 or something like that, since the Napoleonic Wars, I believe is the one that they mentioned. So you made roughly a negative 19% return, and that has only ever happened before during the Napoleonic Wars. So 2022 was already a completely calamitous year for bond investors. And remember, you know, bonds are supposed to be held precisely to avoid this kind of massive drawdown. And then, you know, everybody was sure that 2023 was the year in which they're going to regain their status. And, you know, when you start off with a negative 19 drawdown, the ground is set for you to make a quick death cat bounce, at least. But here we are, half of the year is gone, and the bonds continue to tank. They're basically at the same levels where they were at around the turn of the year, more or less, right? Which is still catastrophic. So basically, we're looking at a lost decade for bonds. The compound annual growth rate of an investment in bonds, even with yield reinvested over the last 10 years, is basically the equivalent of holding cash. It's maybe plus a couple percent, maybe down a couple percent, depending on the instrument that you're holding. But over a decade, it's been a lost decade for bonds. So, Greg, you've spent a lot of time beating the drum of bonds are a scam. And so we're delighted to have you here do some victory laps. Tell us, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, so that's a great intro, because for the listeners, everyone needs to understand why bonds are, they're mathematical. There's no subjectivity to a bond valuation to the extent that it's a contract. The contracts are fixed, or the payments are fixed, therefore they are called fixed income instruments. There's no subjectivity in that the interest rate changes because the company or the country is doing better. You know, it's not like an increased dividend or a decrease in the dividend. It's a contractual return, and therefore it's very mathematical. And in truth, the only return in a bond is its yield or its coupon, because people think about trading bonds for capital gains, i.e. when interest rates fall, existing bonds become more valuable because their coupons tend to be higher than the current environment, and therefore people will pay a higher price for that bond to get those contractual cash flows. What happens is once you cash in the bond at a present value, a gain on your investment, if you have to reinvest the coupons, you have to do it at current market rates, right? Safe. So it's really nothing more than crystallizing a present value gain, but then you turn around and have to place it into a current market where the yield would be lower than the coupon on the old bonds. Now, the flip side also applies. Bonds for the last 40 years have gone from 18%, USA 10 years, 18% all the way to under 1%, bottomed at around 56 basis points or 0.56%, and now have ticked up and are bouncing at around 4% yield. Okay. US 10 years slightly under 3.85% today. They did get as wide as 4.07% just recently. But the point is, can you imagine going from 18% yields all the way down to under 1%? And then you say this is cataclysmic. It's gone from 0.56% up to 4%. And that produced the worst global return in bonds since, as you pointed out, the Napoleonic Wars. This is because in the 1980s, Paul Volcker, then Fed chairman, was fighting inflation and put interest rates to a point where he crushed inflation. And since then, bond yields have been declining. And everyone thought they were making a ton of money on bonds. You are making a ton of money, but if you cash in that 18% coupon and trade it in for a 10% coupon, you get a present value gain on your old bond, but now you're investing at present value. So then get down to the bottom. Here's my favorite one. There was a 100-year Austrian bond, okay? A 100-year Austrian bond that was issued 3 years ago. And it was issued with a coupon, I'm forgetting, I think it was 0.84%. So 84 basis points annually for 100 years, safe. And when it was initially issued, interest rates went even lower in euro land to the point where that bond traded at a price of $139. at issue $100, because interest rates went even lower and in some cases negative in Europe, that bond traded from a price of par up to 139. Guess where it trades today? That same bond is trading today at under $38. So first time in my history, I have ever seen a bond lose more than $100. It went from $139 all the way down to the current price of under $38. This is unbelievable. Like, if you do the mathematics, it's only because the yield on that bond went from issued at 0.84%, traded down to, I could do the math in my head, probably 0.7% yield to maturity for the remaining 99 years. Oh my God, they repriced the whole market. Now for the next 96 years, the yield is reflected in an accurate market of 3%, but that 3% is compensated by a price that's trading at under 40 cents on the dollar. Can you imagine being the insurance company that bought that 100-year bond? Because that's the buyers of those 100-year bonds. They're matching liabilities, an insurance company matching a 100-year liability with an asset that was issued for 100 years. This is,
it's already down 60%.
It's correct. So it's down 60% from its initial.
You've got 96 years to go.
And you have 96 years to go safe. Now, this is math. It hurts. But really, you know, the biggest concern with bonds is not the mathematics. It's what you correctly point out in your book. It's the debasing of the fiat currency that is actually even more penalizing than is the inflation expectations, adjusting interest rates, the general level of interest rates, higher or lower. These are fiat contracts. They are 100% certain to debase, okay? So even if you lend the U.S. Treasury today for 10 years, you lend the U.S. government 10-year money, you get 3.85%. You're highly likely, not certain, because the USA could actually default, and there's a credit default swap market that reflects that possibility. But stick with me, that 3.85%, you're highly likely to get your 3.85% per year for the next 10 years and get your $100 of principal back in 10 years. But what's the value of that $100 of principal in 10 years? It's a debased contract. You are so offside. And that is if you believe, you know, that you're getting 3.85% in an environment where inflation is still ticking, you know, trailing inflation, blah, 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 is still ticking right around 3%. At the end of the day, it's a losing contract. And that's why everybody that owns bonds actually needs to own Bitcoin as a portfolio hedge, because you're not going to get rid of bonds. They are an instrument. They are the largest asset class in the world. Debt in the fiat world is the largest asset class. You won't get rid of it. But everybody that is exposed to debt, meaning you are a lender, you need to have a hedge against the 100% certain debasing of your fiat currency.
Well, I guess that's a good segue for me to get straight to the punchline of asking you why not. I mean, just because it's big doesn't mean it can't fall. Why can't we get rid of the bond market completely? So, I mean, the entire value proposition is being taken out to the woodshed and put out of its misery as we speak. So the whole point was that, you know, you don't want to take risks with this. You lend, you know, the point of buying bonds rather than equity is that with equity, there's equity risk. If the company gets sued, if the company goes bankrupt, your shares can go to zero. But if you're a creditor, then you get first dibs in the case of bankruptcy. And so you're likely to make out better than the equity holder. So that's the whole value proposition, is that you're isolating yourself from risk. And of course, the value proposition for government bonds is that you're isolating yourself from risk even further, because you're lending to somebody who has a literal and figurative money printer that they can use to bail you out, to bail themselves out when they need to pay you. So the whole proposition here is that bonds are a replacement for savings. This is really what it comes down to. And I discussed this in depth in the Fiat Standard and also in Principles of Economics in my new book, that historically people used for saving, they'd hold the money itself, then you'd put the money in a bank, and initially the bank account was able to pay you an interest that was at least meant to beat inflation. And then, of course, you know, hilarious consequences would ensue every time. And then, you know, Alan Farrington shows up at the end to ask, but where does the yield come from? And then everything falls apart, as always. So that was, you know, the bank account was the original saving instrument. So the money doesn't work, but you could just put it in the bank. They'll magically make a yield for you, and then you'll beat inflation. Well, that didn't work. And so now everybody goes to bonds. Well, now bonds don't work anymore. And like, I think something momentous shifted in 2020. Like, if you look at the chart of bonds, it really was March 2020. Up until then, you look at the returns, you know, the long-term returns of holding bonds, it was something in the range of 5, 10% or something like that. Generally, it beats inflation. So you could have held bond to, you know, make it the base of your portfolio, to make it the part of your portfolio that you don't take risk with, and then speculated, took more risk with the rest of your portfolio, you know, the 40-60 traditional split. And with the bond part, you know, you either beat inflation, came close to beating inflation, depending on how you calculate inflation. But, you know, even if you look at CPI, you obviously beat CPI, but, you know, that's rigged. But before March 2020, you could even arguably beat real inflation. Like, if you think of inflation as being 5, 6, 7%, you could even say that bonds came close to beating that in terms of their returns. So, you know, in real terms, you were doing all right. You weren't getting robbed very blatantly. It was not like holding physical cash. It was clearly much better than holding physical cash, and it was clearly better than holding deposits at a bank account where interest rates were very low. But starting March 2020, that value proposition is compromised, and it's compromised for everybody. So even the U.S. government, which is, you know, the owner of the magical fiat printer, is stiffing its creditors with a negative 20%. I mean, that's an incredibly large loss. And so, why do you see this continuing? Why don't you think people can just shift out of it? And, you know, we're in a digital age in which these things can happen very quickly. So I hate to make you a bond bull, Greg, but yeah, no, why? Give me the bullish case for bonds.
The bullish case is as far, okay, I cannot paint a bullish case for bonds, but I can paint a case where bonds continue to exist, perhaps as a transitory mechanism, as you point out, you know, in certain arguments. But it's like everything. Two systems need to exist in parallel. It's not like a light switch. One goes, you know, you don't transfer the whole system overnight. The reality is banking itself is the fiat Ponzi transfer mechanism. And the banks are levered 25 times to their equity capital base. And in that leverage, you can own instruments that pay a coupon that is lower than would be required in an equity-based environment, because they can leverage that, let's say, interest margin of, call it 3%. When you leverage that 25 times, you are creating equity returns for the capital base in the bank that are appropriate for the risk of banking. Now, banking is extremely risky. Nobody thinks of banking as being extremely risky, but it actually is an incredibly risky business that needs to have the too big to fail money printer behind the banking system in order to create the confidence in the system. And who is the too big to fail? Well, that are the money center banks, and they are protected by the central banks of the major economies. Well, the central banks of the major economies need to fund themselves in order to create or continue this fiat Ponzi. There's no equity per se in the governments of the central, you know, of the G7 nations. So their only funding mechanism is bonds, and they have to continue that funding mechanism in order to facilitate the commercial banking fiat Ponzi transfer mechanism. There's a lot of companies. Did you know, for example, that one of the largest pension plans in Canada, and we just examined this with, I'm not sure, have you met Hoffa? On Twitter, his handle is Alpha Zeta. And Hoffa is the CIO of Swan Bitcoin. And he's designed this portfolio. It's actually ingenious, this open source software portfolio analytics that is called NakamotoPortfolio.com, where you can plug any mixture of assets into a portfolio and it'll show you what the optimal portfolio allocation to Bitcoin is. Well, we did that exercise. I was a guest on the show. We did that exercise for Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, one of Canada's largest pension plans. They own a very diversified mix of bonds and stocks and private equity. But 30 years ago, did you know that Ontario Teachers Pension Plan had one investment bucket, and that was Province of Ontario government bonds? That's the only asset that the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan was allowed to own 30 years ago. And eventually some of their portfolio analytics team said, boy, we need to diversify more. And along came Bankers Trust and developed for them what's called an asset swap, where they swapped the cash flows of the government bonds that were generating annual cash flows because of the contractual coupon. They swapped that into asset swaps on the S&P 500. And Ontario Teachers was gradually able to transition out of a 100% exposure to bonds into an exposure that is sort of mimics your 60-40 portfolio that you just mentioned. But it takes time. And here's the kicker. Within Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, it was determined that they should own 25% of their portfolio in Bitcoin to be a proper portfolio hedge against all of their other assets. Every portfolio will be different, Safe, but here's the craziest thing. Can you imagine if any portfolio owned 25% of Bitcoin? It's coming. That day is coming, but it's not a light switch, okay? And that's, I guess, my argument. I'm a bond realist. Bonds will always exist in a fiat system. If the fiat system eventually collapses, which it will in various degrees around the world, then bonds are no more. But in any system that still relies on fiat, it is my belief there will be bonds. Does it mean you should be totally allocated to those bonds? Absolutely not. But insurance companies, until they change their risk measurement systems and asset liability matching, bonds will be a component of their business model, because there's not other instruments, as you said, that are contractual. See, the thing about a bond and all of these statisticians that get in there, you know the cash flows. They are programmed. They are contractual, whereas in equity, the prices go up, prices go down. So big circle, did you know that Ontario Teachers, of their equity allocation, 7% of their equity allocation is in one stock called Microsoft? Well, a pension plan like Ontario Teachers that has 7% allocation of their equity bucket, 7% is in Microsoft, don't you think they should be able to find a way that 1% of their overall portfolio is allocated to Bitcoin, the best performing asset? And it's in that way that traction will gain, in my opinion. But I don't see a time when bonds just evaporate. The US Treasury will be the last fiat to fail. And until they fail, they'll continue to feed the QE Infinity money printer to allow the perception that they're paying down debt. They're not paying down debt. They're rolling over debt with new money and expanding the supply of money. But call it a bond, call it whatever you want. I guess I just call it part of the fiat Ponzi transfer mechanism. Long-winded response to the it's only been 14 years since Satoshi, you know, was so generous with this innovation for us. It's going to take time. And I think that that some big things are coming for Bitcoin, but bonds or total global debt, safe, $400 trillion. Man, that's 40 times the size of the gold market. Hard to get rid of that thing, you know, like a light switch.
Yeah, no, I mean, I should be clear. When I say the end, I, you know, I don't mean next weekend. I think what we have now is, so people like you and me have been saying Bitcoin is the alternative treasury cash asset that is going to eat the lunch of everything else. And up until 2019, I guess this was compelling only when you brought up examples like Venezuela and Zimbabwe and places where people highly associate things with hyperinflation. Maybe even, you know, Cyprus, Turkey, Argentina, you know, high levels of inflation where being able to use Bitcoin makes sense. But until then, until 2020, you still had your average, you know, both just average person as well as your average hedge fund manager, as well as your average sovereign wealth fund guy, looking at their treasuries as their bedrock of their portfolio and expecting that they're going to continue to do a good job. That they're going to just, you know, do somewhere between -3% and +8% while you take more risks with everything else. And that was expected to beat inflation because inflation was, you know, assigned to the dustbin of history with 2% or 3% or something like that. But I think something has drastically changed over the last couple of years, because Once you breach that trust of being the safe haven, once you move towards saying, you know, we can give you 19% down in a year, just like any shitcoin out there, you can't turn around and...
That was inflation though, eh? That we have to be clear. That was because of inflation expectations. It wasn't largely a credit event yet. For the large G7 nations in the world,
yeah,
this repricing of the bond market was all because of inflation expectations. And bond returns are backward looking, which means it's weighted with the old coupons in the market. Wait until the new coupons in the market, which, you know, got down to as low as I said, 0.56% in the US 10-year. Wait until that 10-year bond is now the 5-year bond, because it's matured for 5 years, or it's paid down for 5 years and it still has 5 years to maturity. That 5-year bond will be trading at a price of 70 cents on the dollar. Historically, a 10-year bond that was issued at 5% and now interest rates are 3% after 5 years was trading at a premium. You see, this is how people thought they made money. No, you didn't make any money. Again, it's just the cash flow cash flow calculations of a different coupon. So the entire bond market will reprice, in that where bonds that were issued in prior years traded at a premium to parity because of declining interest rates, now because of rising interest rates since they were issued, they're all be traded at a discount. This changes the calculations of the global bond returns, that everybody looks in a backward-looking way. And here's the key thing, and this is the basis of my entire thesis. We have not even begun to price in credit risk of these fiat-issuing nations. There is a credit default swap market on the USA. It's de minimis compared to its true default risk. And once people set a 10-year government rate that includes an inflation expectation, but then, oh my goodness, safe, we got to start pricing in some default risk on the USA. Holy moly. This is what changes the entire dynamic. You've gone from an inflation model to a credit risk model. And this is where things really start to spiral out of control. Because if people start questioning the solvency of the US Treasury, they're not going to be just worried about inflation. They're going to be worried about default risk as well. And that's why I always look to the credit default swap markets for truth Inflation is here and there. All of these guys think they can predict it. If they could have actually predicted inflation correctly, would they have ever brought rates for a U.S. 10-year down to 0.56%? No. They would have said, well, in years, you know, the next 4 years, we're going to go back up to a 4% and 5% and 8% inflation. They never predicted that. And neither did Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, who said, remember, we're going to be lower for longer. And that's why all the banks piled into these long-term treasury bonds with 0% capital risk or 0% capital allocation, so infinite return on capital. Oh, I get this free yield from the U.S. government. Rates are going to be lower for longer. Uh-oh, the bond I just invested in at 100 cents on the dollar, it's trading at 60 now. Not because of credit risk, a little bit because of credit risk, mostly because of inflation risk. And that's where you have to differentiate between inflation expectations and credit risk. And this is coming. And where does it come? It comes in places like Venezuela and Lebanon and places like Argentina, which is a G20 country. But guess what? I've been trading bonds for 30 years and Argentina has defaulted 4 times in my career. 4 times they defaulted in 30 years, which is to say there's never been a 30-year bond that has matured in Argentina. They've always issued, defaulted, reissued, defaulted, reissued, defaulted. Who's the biggest fool at the party? Well, that day could be coming for a G7 country, because Argentina, G20, a G7 country. Guess what country is likely that to be? Safe. I know you don't live here anymore.
Canada.
But that country is likely to be Canada, unfortunately. My home country. Run by a mathematical illiterate that says things like the budget will balance itself. And that's when credit risk becomes a concern, because budgets don't balance themselves. And any owner of a Government of Canada bond whose CEO said, oh, don't worry, we'll let the budget balance itself. You got to start thinking, dude. This guy doesn't know how to run a balanced budget, which means credit risk increases, which means I got to start adding increased yield for my return, which includes inflation expectations. Uh-oh, now we're starting to mess with this thing called credit risk. And that's where I spent my entire career, Safe, trading high yield credit or risky credit for corporations. Countries are no different than corporations. When the market starts pricing in the probability of default, look out. You're going to get run over. And then that poor country has to issue at higher and higher coupons. And then the death spiral or debt spiral becomes a death spiral. So that's the outcome. And it'll be successive countries. You know, what is, there was a G11 country. I guess Turkey might even be G11. So we're down to a G11 country that's having problems. Well, Canada's only 4, you know, notches away. Canada's G7. Don't say it can't happen, because it happened in a G11 country. Oh boy.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddine.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last with an ice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, I mean, Turkey are like up there with Argentina when it comes to doing this stuff. They are.
That's fair.
You know, but still, they're always there.
It's a G11 economy. It's not, you know, it's not one of the bottom 100 economies in the world.
No, no. And they're all run structurally the same. I mean,
okay.
High time preference people in power can speed up the process. But ultimately,
yes,
it's the same Ponzi that exists wherein.
Absolutely.
You're using people's money in the banking system and in savings in bonds as a giant slush fund for the government and the central bank and the banking system. And, you know, just telling everybody, hey, let's pour everything in and then magically everybody will get to take more home. And if you believe that, then you are the one who's going to be getting the short end of the stick. But I think what's different now is, I mean, I agree with your thesis, but I feel myself being as, you know, just like when no coiners are making FUD about Bitcoin.
Yes.
This is me FUDing the treasury market. So let's do it. You know, they're always telling us how Bitcoin is going down. So let's FUD them in return. I guess what I'm trying to say is, before we even get to this kind of a credit risk situation where they are even thinking of it in terms of, will Canada actually default? Does the fact that the prime minister is enumerate actually matter to anything? Before they even start asking that question, there's a very simple, basic level question, which is, you know, you look at the performance of the things that you're looking at. And so if you're 20, 30, 40% of your portfolio that you're being the most conservative with gave you a negative 19% last year, and it's shaping up for giving you another L this year. You know, you think we'll end the year positive or negative or somewhere
around it doesn't matter because it's still not an appropriate return. Whatever return you're going to get in bonds this year, it does not reflect the true risk of owning bonds. So it's a subpar returning investment.
You'd need to do basically a 30% this year to make up for last year, I'd say.
But you can't. What that would mean, so let's do a quick, we could do the quick math as to where interest rates would have to go to in U.S. 10 years in order for bond prices to go up 30%. And it's a simple calculation, right? You take your maturity or your duration, it's a duration calculation. The duration of a 10-year bond is approximately an 8, okay? It's a quantifiable number. On an 8, in order for something to go up 30 bond points, you have to decrease rates by 4%. 4 times 8 is 32. That would be the increase in price. Do you think that 10-year rates are going to go from 4% all the way back down to 0.5%? No, not in your lifetime. I mean, it's possible, but not in 1 year. So that's the only way you could get a 30% return this year in bonds. Not going to happen, people. What is a bond? Again, it is that contract priced today for the next 10 years. And the only thing that you get is a coupon. And that is your yield to maturity. So you could say, oh, I earned 30% 1 year for bonds. No, all you did is brought forward those coupons that were 10% yields and you cashed them in for an 8% yield. Or a 6% yield. You know, that's how the math works. So there's no way that you are going to make back that 19% loss from last year unless interest rates go from 4% down to 1%. Are they going to do that? Not in an inflation environment that still is where it is. So that's why bonds are, you know, they giveth and they taketh away. But it's just a present value measuring system. And that's why I love what you're saying, because you see, most people are now realizing the bond portfolio managers of the last 40 years, they loved life because they could show positive returns that were in excess of the true cash flows. Oh, I'm a superstar. I got a present value return of 30%, even though the coupon on the portfolio was 10%. I got a 30% return 1 year. No. All you did is pulled forward future returns and cashed them in this year, right? Safe. And that's what bond guys for 40 years never realized. And now you finally have guys that are experiencing a bond bear market. There's nobody that's experienced a bond bear market for the last 40 years that's still managing money. And that's why these poor guys got run over, deer in the headlights, and they counted on things like in the European Union, oh, don't worry, we're going to take yields negative. And that was how they tried to pretend that they would still keep this bond Ponzi going. So, you know, all you have in a bond is for the next 10 years, barring a default in the US Treasury, I guarantee you the return in nominal returns is 3.85% per year for the next 10 years. That is what a bond is. If you pull forward 9 of the years because you cash in that 3.85% coupon for a 1% coupon going forward, you'll get a plus 30% return this year. But then back end weighted, you're down to 1% return for the next nine years. And that's bonds, right? Bond math 101. It's pretty simple, although most people don't understand it. It's convexity, well, duration and convexity on the pricing of bonds. Much like your physics, and I'm sorry, but I know you're a mathematician. Duration and convexity are the equivalent of velocity and acceleration in your distance calculation in physics, where distance equals velocity times change in time plus 1/2 acceleration times change in time squared. Well, the change in a price of bond is negative your duration times your change in interest rate plus 1/2 convexity times your change in interest rate squared. It's a beautiful thing. It's called the Taylor formula, and it's math. And that's why engineers love bonds and can figure out math. And that's anybody who's calculating a 30% return. No, all you've done is played with the bond math and pulled forward present value today. And that's key because you understand it. And this is when you push back on people and say, no, you can't get 30% without squeezing the blood from the orange or the stone and, you know, penalizing your next 9 years of performance.
Yeah, but I mean, that would be a very high time preference thing to do.
So. That's what they do. Thank you, sir.
Very on brand.
I've never thought of it that way because they get paid their bonus on an annual basis. So their bonuses are paid on an annual basis. So there you go. A very high time preference thing to do. Oh, and by the way, they don't actually have to sell the bonds, because their portfolios are automatically marked to market. That's in a bond portfolio. Guess what portfolios are not automatically marked to market? Oh, yeah. The portfolios of bonds that live on the balance sheets of commercial banks. They're in this magical basket called held to maturity. They don't have to get marked to market. Well, Bank of America is sitting on $100 billion of losses, people. But don't worry. They don't have to get marked to market because, you know, it's in this magical bucket called held to maturity.
It's the nice thing about fiat that everything is make-believe. So they can just,
This is why I love being with you, because you always have the, that's the truth. I mean, that is absolutely the truth. It's make-believe.
You know that Drew Carey show, Whose Line Is It Anyway? Where the points are made up, where the lines are made up and the points don't matter. That's the fiat system. So at the end of the day, you can just give anybody whatever score you want on the fiat Ponzi. And they can, you know, as long as they're on good terms with the government, you can always bail people out. But, you know, go back to our FUD, back to our bond market FUD. Before we even get to the credit risk, I think this is just a simple portfolio allocation problem now, which is that if you're trying to think about the safe part of your portfolio, the part that you want to take the least risk with, then, you know, 19% last year and probably something close to zero this year, approximately. So far, we're around that level. So, you know, your average everywhere from retiree to hedge fund manager to sovereign wealth fund asset allocator is naturally going to have to think, nope, I can't count on this as being part of the long-term bulwark for the portfolio. This can't be the nest egg. This is getting more and more into meme stock territory, and I need to start treating it accordingly. And so I think, you know, this kind of sentiment shift, which I don't think has really sunk in yet, because the key thing about the way that the bond market works, I think, is the fact that people don't understand it. And this is the glue that holds the whole thing together. And once you get Bitcoin, you get how it works because you compare it to Bitcoin. And so for me, like, you know, most people are just so confused by the headlines of The main confusing thing about bonds is, you know, when interest rates go up, the price of the bond goes down. Yeah. So people are confused because they see people posting charts of interest rates going up and then saying, you know, bonds are wrecked. And like, it's going up. Why are they wrecked?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, it seems like it's a simple confusion, but it's very lucrative confusion because it keeps it keeps the whole Ponzi ticking along. But so for me, ultimately, I just look at the bond equivalent ETF performance over time.
Yes.
And then you just compare that to Bitcoin. And that's what it comes down to. And this really is a cheat code because everything else, you know, there's news. And of course, you know, if you follow the financial press, then every day there's a thing that you should focus on. Every day there's a new distraction and they're talking about rates and they're talking about all kinds of different things that you miss. The simple goalpost that you're aiming for. The goalpost here is that you need number to go up. That's what it really comes down to. And that's what I love about Bitcoin and the simplicity and the straightforwardness of Bitcoin, which is it's just out there. And there's a liquid market in it everywhere in the world right now. And it's there's a global price. And you can see that the number does indeed go up. And that's what you're after. And so with bonds now, It's not sunk in because most people don't think of their bonds like that, but over time it's going to sink in, and it's going to sink in consciously, or it's going to sink in even if they don't consciously realize it in the brutal way that I discuss in the Bitcoin Stand, which is that if you choose the inferior stores of value, then, you know, it doesn't matter what you choose anymore because you don't have a store value to store anymore. So people who store wealth in these kind of primitive financial instruments like bonds are just going to be mattered less and less as part of the allocation because their portfolios are declining in terms of value compared to other
things. I will agree. Can I, sorry to interject. I agree, but it won't be a drastic cliff. It's going to be a step function down in terms of the portfolio allocation now, but here's the key, right? If you're step functioning down the amount of bonds you want to hold in your portfolio, when the flip side is governments have to issue more and more bonds than they ever had to because of deficit spending as well as interest expense that is exploding on the government debt, you have supply that's increasing. And the demand in the portfolio that's step function decreasing, holy smokes. That is a fiscal dominance type of, I first saw that reference to fiscal dominance from Lynn Alden, but that is a fiscal dominance scenario that leads to interest rates being higher regardless of where inflation expectations are. Isn't that dangerous too, Safe? And that accelerates what you're saying, I think, right?
Yeah.
That accelerates the step function being slow to the step function being more drastic. And yeah, it's the math of the situation. Sorry to interject, but I'm nodding in agreement. I'm a bond bear. And yet I'm still trying to tell you that I think it'll be, you know, it'll be, well, it won't be an on-off switch. It'll be a progression.
No, it'll be gradual. I think, you know, we may watch it for the rest of our time on Earth play out. But I think we can see how it is, you know, I mean, we went 19% of the way last year. So we just have 81% left to take bonds to zero. I mean,
yeah, what you did is you had pulled forward the years prior to that. You had pulled fake returns forward. So the years that you were pulling those forward, you played catch up last year and lost 19%. You know, I mean, that's the game of math. It's just mathematics. You can't outsmart mathematics. And if you pull them forward, you got to pay the piper at the back end of the term.
But like ultimately, the thing that holds all of this together is that usually, you know, whenever there's a business cycle, the reason that things get back on back running again is because ultimately, when things go bad, everybody runs to the store of value that is the least risky. And because that happens, everybody runs into usually, you know, since 1918 or so, it's been the US bonds.
Yes.
Before that, it was the British bonds. And so for the last couple of hundred centuries, you know, it was either the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve. You went to one of these banks.
Yes.
And you bought the government bond. And that was what everybody did when things were bad.
Correct.
Because That's the protection. And then because of that, you basically gave all the money. That's really how the Ponzi works, in that every, lower interest rates creates a boom. Everybody's out there taking reckless risks. And then when they raise interest rates, then the music stops, everything collapses. All the money goes back to the bank, the central bank, because everybody wants to buy bonds, the central bank and the treasury, basically. They get all the money, and then they get to decide who lives or dies. And that's how the central bank and the government strengthen their control over society, because, you know, whatever it is that you do, you can be bankrupted depending on your relationship with your local bank, because everything is up about the interest rate variations.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, the tricky part this time is that safe haven has stopped working as a safe haven. This is the really remarkable thing about this 19%. It's not just 19%
in
stocks. It's a much bigger deal. This is 19% in the bedrock. This was the money that the U.S. government should have been using now to consolidate its strength and power. But it's not getting that demand, and the Ponzi is coming to its end. So the difference now, perhaps, I mean, I don't think it's made a difference yet, but the difference now is that there is something that can protect you from this. There is a way out. And that's what we've never had before. Ultimately, you know, the more desperate you got, the more you went and bought long-term U.S. treasuries. The worse you thought things were going to be, the more treasuries you bought. And so that's where the game ended. That's where, you know, the panic would subside and the government would step in. Well, now we don't have that. And we have this other thing that's gearing up and revving its wheels. And that's, the orange coin.
That is.
It really is. It's a no-brainer.
You know what you're describing, and I don't want to get too technical for you, but you're describing the difference between what's called a short volatility asset and a long volatility asset. And stick with me very quickly here. Think of the VIX as being a measure of volatility, which it is. It's a measure of equity volatility. But when equity vol spikes, because people get nervous and price options as insurance at higher prices, when the equity vol spikes, that is typically when equities fall drastically in price, correct? So if you own equities and an equity spikes, and vol spikes and the equity falls, that means it's a short volatility asset. And you're totally correct that bonds were the recipient of those, a spike in yield, a spike in VIX translated generally to a fall in yields, which translated to a gain in the price of bonds. So bonds were your long volatility, meaning when the VIX spiked, bonds would perform positively. They were long vol correlated. And you had these two things that were balancing each other, short vol assets, which were equities, against long vol assets. Then all of a sudden, the mathematics of bonds turned around and they also became a short volatility asset, which meant the equity market sold off and so did bonds. And that's what happened last year. They were both positively correlated to each other. They were both long volatility assets, short volatility assets, which meant when the VIX spiked and you're short something that goes higher, you're getting squeezed and you lost money. That's why I always say Bitcoin is your ultimate insurance policy, and therefore it is long volatility. Okay, when the VIX spikes, Bitcoin should rally when the world realizes what it is. It is actually not a risk asset. It's a risk off asset. When the world is imploding, people are going to run to Bitcoin, in my opinion, as a long volatility asset that has replaced treasuries. I think that's what you were trying to say. This new asset now exists that is called a long volatility asset. And that's the beautiful thing about Bitcoin. It is the perfect option. It's the world's most perfect option. If you guys know option pricing, you are long volatility. You have no time expiry, so there's no theta. You're long volatility, and there's going to be a gamma squeeze where people run into Bitcoin because it is now. the global store of value and has replaced US treasuries as that asset. And that's why I say you could have a green candle on Bitcoin that could absolutely melt faces because people finally realize, oh my God, it's my insurance contract that I have needed and treasuries don't offer me that insurance anymore. Sorry again to jump on your thing.
No.
Bringing some financial lingo into your thought process. Bitcoin is the most beautiful long volatility asset that I have ever seen. And why is it long volatility? Because it's short credit. And when you are short credit, you are long volatility. And that's what everybody needs to have as portfolio insurance.
Yeah. And I think reality is imposing itself in this regard. I think it's been a very rough few years if you have not held Bitcoin. I mean, at this point, you know, between stocks and bonds, practically very few people are managing to beat inflation in the long run as calculated in terms of the things that you actually want to buy. So the problem with the CPI is that it's calculated with the things that, you know, that are designed so that the price doesn't go up.
Hamburger versus steak.
Yeah, well, soy burger versus steak, not even
okay,
hamburger.
Okay, there you go. There you go, brother.
That's really how it's being done. And where, you know, I tell people, look at the CPI as the measure of the house that you live in, you know, the house that you'd rather buy. Think of your dream house. Think of how much its price has been going up. And that's your inflation rate. That's the inflation rate that really matters to you, not the CPI that you're being told. The fiat inflation rate where they tell you what it should be, you know, whereas you're experiencing a much higher rate in your real life. So I think that number is significantly higher and you're not being able to beat it now with the fiat games, you know, up until 2020. Really, it seems like it was the turning point up until 2020 between bonds and stocks.
Correct. Yeah.
You could beat.
Well, don't forget 2020 corresponded to when yields were at 0.56%. Again, that's the math. That's the 10-year math. That's exactly when yields went to 0.56%. And since then, yields have gone up to 4%. So hence the blood in the streets.
Yeah. So, I mean, we obviously agree on this, but where do you see this changing the situation in terms of the solvency of sovereigns? So, I mean, all of these bonds, in a sense, their liabilities have been devalued. Does that mean that they're better off now, that they have to pay off less liabilities, or no, they still are?
Well, I mean, look at the math. So with the U.S. government, for example, they're running 6% annual fiscal deficits, right? 6%, they're taking in 6% less revenue than their expenditures. So that means that the federal debt is expanding organically by 6%. Plus, you have to add on the interest expense, which this year will surpass $1 trillion annually in interest. The budget's only $4 trillion, and they're running a deficit of 6% of GDP, 6% of $24 trillion gives you a $1.2 trillion addition to the deficit because of fiscal. And then another $1 trillion because of interest expense? Holy smokes. This is when people start realizing that the math doesn't work and that we will be at a $50 trillion government deficit or cumulative deficit by the year 2030. Right now we're at $32 trillion and you'll be at $50 trillion by the year 2030. There's not enough money in the world to pay that deficit unless what, Safe?
They make that money.
Unless they print it. Unless they print it. That's called the reality of the quantitative easing infinity, which will make all hard assets increase in value. Not because the value has actually changed, but the measuring stick has declined so that it takes more of the unit of account to buy that same asset. I love when you say and other Bitcoiners say, look, one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. If we don't measure it against fiat, if you just say to yourself, imagine we had the luxury of owning 1,000 Bitcoin right now at a turn of a, you know, I want to invest 1,000 Bitcoin is $30 million. Okay. Well, there are large pension plans that can own 1,000 Bitcoin on a turn of a switch. They can invest $30 million. Well, you know what the crazy thing is? That means they own 1/21,000th of the supply of Bitcoin, one person or one entity. Like Michael Saylor is well on his way because he owns 150,000 Bitcoin. Like it's just when the door opens, it will be monumental. And we talked about Ontario Teachers. Ontario Teachers is unlikely to get involved in Bitcoin until CalPERS does. Because Ontario Teachers is typically a lagger, not a leader. Although Ontario Teachers did invest in FTX, they invested in FTX out of their small cap venture cap portfolio, not out of any major bucket. But CalPERS, and when a large globally recognized pension plan puts Bitcoin on their balance sheet for real, you watch all the Canadian pension plans that are going to open their eyes and say, hey, it's been cleared. It's no longer career risk that I can own Bitcoin. That is when the bond allocation starts to say, damn, I don't need 40% of my portfolio in bonds. Maybe I can stick only 30% of my portfolio in bonds, take the incremental 10% and put 5% in Bitcoin and 5% in some other asset. Oh my God. That's when Bitcoin absolutely goes turbocharged as measured in fiat. But as measured in Bitcoin, nah. One Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin, and there's only 21 million of them.
Yeah.
And if you're the luxury of buying a big chunk of that, oh, you are in good shape.
Yeah, and I mean, the Bitcoin economy is stable. We're just slowly repricing down the entirety of fiat world until we subsume it into 21 million Bitcoin. That's basically what we're doing around here. No, I think that's a pretty compelling case. Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, maybe trying to connect some dots here. Perhaps this is ultimately the play for people like BlackRock. I think this is, maybe it's a little presumptuous, but, you know, in the same way that we're fighting the treasury market, let's pump the Bitcoin market. You know, BlackRock are the world's biggest traders of bonds. They are the biggest entity in the global bond market. So they trade, I forget the number now, but some ungodly amount of bonds every year. They are the bond market. They are the biggest player in the bond market. And they hold a very large number of bonds. And their interest in Bitcoin, in my opinion, is extremely telling. Because if they are interested in Bitcoin, there's a highly likely possibility that they view Bitcoin as a bond alternative. And you know, Larry Fink's discussion on MSNBC, he did not say they're a bond alternative. He said they're gold, they're digital gold. But what bonds are essentially an alternative to gold. I mean, the point of bonds is it's not equity. You're not taking on risk. You're not going to get a million X because you found the next Facebook at its infancy. It's not venture capital. It's not stock trading. And it's not equity at a company. It's supposed to be the cash part of your portfolio, the safe part of your portfolio. So effectively, bonds are the replacement for gold. And so, you know, Bitcoin, saying Bitcoin is digital gold is useful pedagogically, useful to communicate the properties of Bitcoin. But the gold that Bitcoin is after, the real gold here is at the end. The gold that's at the end of the fiat rainbow is the bond market. That's the big bond.
Yes, sir. And it's because, again, I'll say it, because it will replace bonds as the long volatility insurance part of your portfolio. Bitcoin will replace bonds as the long vol asset in your portfolio. And everybody needs long volatility assets in a world of short volatility assets. 100%, I love that analogy that you just laid out. And, you know, to beat a dead horse, it's not BlackRock that is the world's largest bond trader, safe. It is the clients of BlackRock that have given BlackRock the money to invest in global bond markets on their behalf, right? So BlackRock is just the platform, and the big pension plans of the world allocate money to BlackRock to put them in this risk bucket. But ultimately, the choice always comes down to the pension plan allocators. And so I'm not sure if I'll derail this conversation. Do you have a probability in your mind of what a BlackRock ETF approval will be within the next 12 months? Do you have a probability in your head?
I'm going to say 55, 60%, something like that.
Okay. I hope this helps your podcast gain some insight, gain some inside knowledge. So I work in Canada with someone who's very close to the spot Bitcoin ETF creation redemption process for the Canadian markets. And as your listeners may or may not know, Canada, we do have over five different spot Bitcoin ETFs, including Fidelity. Fidelity Canada has a spot Bitcoin ETF in Canada that trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange. The gentleman at one of these large ETFs gives a probability in the next 12 months, and he's an expert, over 90% likelihood of approval. That blew my mind when I heard that, and he's the expert. Now, I like to think of experts. Now, nothing is 100% certain and things can change, but he believes that because of the creation redemption process that is included in the BlackRock spot ETF application, which mimics the way it's done in Canada, it will give regulators comfort that spot prices cannot be manipulated for the 4 p.m. close price. And this is really important because BlackRock wants a spot-based ETF. Why? Not because BlackRock wants it safe, because the clients of BlackRock want it. And it's the clients of BlackRock that have bond exposure. And it's the clients of BlackRock that realize that these bonds are a failed investment going forward. And they need to move money out of that into a new asset silo. So I think the combination of the reality of bond market math, the new pricing mechanisms that they've included in these spot-based ETF applications in the US gives it a very high likelihood of approval within the next 12 months. And so 55%, which you said, I think is low. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying I think that's low. Yeah. And therefore, it's the clients of BlackRock that are asking for this. And that is key.
Yeah, I mean, I don't generally have any particular insight into the regulatory process. But yeah, it's just... I'm going by the fact that BlackRock seems
I hope that added value just because, you know, this is where Canada, although, you know, most Americans can't even find Canada on a map. At the end of the day, Canada can add some value in terms of where, you know, what we've experienced up here in the attic. As I say, Canada is the attic of the United States. Sometimes you should look into the attic and see what's happening in the attic and see what the probabilities change in terms of likelihood of approval or not. But and by the way, I see in one of the comments here that the BlackRock ETF will depress the price of BTC. No, that is wrong. Because you can't audit gold, but you can audit Bitcoin. And all of this worrying about BlackRock creating paper BTC, it exists if you couldn't audit Bitcoin. But since you can audit the Bitcoin blockchain for 21 million fixed supply, all this worrying about suppressing the price of Bitcoin, I think is overblown. It's very key to understand the difference between a gold market, which you cannot audit and allows JP Morgan to be short more than the entire market cap of gold. Yeah, you can't audit it, but Bitcoin, you can. COMEX gold can be audited? Wrong, okay? See, you got to understand that gold is not just COMEX. Gold is an entire market. Bitcoin is not confined by a given exchange. So look, you guys can have your worries. My opinion is the BlackRock ETF is very positive for the adoption of Bitcoin by institutions. Ultimately, not your keys, not your coins, yes, but it's a stepping stone to get this understood. Because what are we relying on? We're relying on 21 million supply backed by math and code, decentralized. I believe it's positive, and I believe the likelihood of regulatory acceptance is higher than the market is giving it right now.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. I think the issue of auditability is a big deal. And I think the other aspect of it that makes things very different, and that's really the key point of the fiat standard, is that with gold, if you wanted to call bullshit on what's going on at the London Bullion Market Association, you can't just tell them, hey, give me the gold and I'm going to take it out and I'm going to send it somewhere else and I want to ship it halfway around the world. It's an enormously expensive process.
Agreed.
The only way that you can verify that you've sent gold to somebody, the only way they can verify that they've received the gold from you without having to take your word for it, when you're talking about large gold bars, which is what we need to settle large sums, which is, each gold bar is around $750,000 or so. So if you're talking about large sums between central banks or financial institutions, you're going to be needing to move large quantities of these bars. And each time they move between two parties that don't trust each other, the only way that they could verify that it is indeed 100% what it says it is to melt the whole gold bar down and cast it again. And that's essentially what a Bitcoin transaction is, but it does it at an infinitely cheaper cost. And so that's what ultimately is the winning ace up our sleeves as Bitcoiners. Is that if they do decide to want to build, a lot of people talking about a BRICS currency, the BRICS are going to get together and get on a gold standard. I mean, it's hilarious enough to imagine these governments actually going for a gold standard. I mean, anybody who's ever been to any of those countries or knows anybody from those countries will tell you these governments are the last thing that you could associate with a gold standard. They cannot even understand what a gold standard is and how it would work. And it's hilarious that they talk about it. They'd like to have a gold settlement system between them, but they don't realize that that necessitates that they have to make their currency redeemable for gold. So they have to go on a gold standard. And that means no more money printing. That means you go back to not having a money printer.
Love it. This is why you're so rational. I mean, this is it's just ultimately they wish for things that they realize, oh my gosh, if I think this through, it takes away my ability to magically create money out of thin air and solve the debt spiral, D-E-B-T spiral. But I wanted to give a shout out to your Max, okay? Max, who used to be Max Pleb, I can't remember what Max's handle was.
Max DeMarco, he used to be Pleb Music. Now,
yeah, Pleb Music. Okay, so Pleb Music made the greatest video of me where I was saying, debt spiral, D-E-B-T, debt spiral. And I'm dancing around like this, and maybe you can incorporate it on your podcast when this goes, because it is my favorite music video that Max did, for me, I've ever seen. And it's absolutely hilarious. And it's all mathematics safe, okay? And watch if I can't imagine if I'm going to be wearing the same t-shirt. I hope I'm not. But I remember Max was the guy. D-E-B-T, debt spiral. It's only mathematics. Mathematics.
I am 100% certain that fiats will continue to debase because they cannot possibly stop printing money due to the DEBT debt spiral that all fiat countries are in today. It is 100% certain mathematically that fiat currencies will continue to debase.
You need to put in more money and more funding.
Prices are up now.
Guess what? You need to put in more money.
Prices are up now.
It's math, guys. Very simple. Mathematically, now it's only math, Peter. Now it's only math, Peter. Mathematically, math, because it's only math, Peter. Now it's only math. D-E-B-T, debt, spiral. D-E-B-T, debt, pure math. Pure, simple mathematics. Grade 11 type of math is what I like to say. Mathematically, now it's only math, Peter. Now it's only math, Peter. Mathematically, math, because it's only math, Peter. Now it's only math. D-E-B-T, debt, spiral. It's math, guys. Now it's only math. Pure math. Pure, simple mathematics. Grade 11 type of math is what I like to say.
By the way, that's all it is. Okay, go on the gold standard. Then you take away your ability to solve the debt spiral by printing more quantitative easing. You can't do it. You're out of a job. The world economy crashes. Okay, so much for this BRICS currency.
Yeah, no, it's not happening. I mean, how are you going to pay off all of your liabilities if your currency starts to appreciate when it's backed by gold? Where are you going to get all that gold from?
Attaboy.
Yeah, no, you're basically, there's no way all of these governments are massively tied to their fiat money printers.
Correct.
And I said this many years ago, and I continue to stand by it. They may hate the U.S. dollar, but they love their own money printers more. So they love fiat money. They love having a printer more than they hate the U.S. dollar. So it's easy for them to virtue signal and say that, you know, we want to get off the dollar. But the only reason they think it's doable is because they don't understand what it takes. This is just, this is almost like me saying, you know, I want to win the World Cup. That's it. Next World Cup, I want to go and win it. I'm going to be the guy who lifts the trophy. As if, you know, I'm just going to go walk in and just do it, you know, because,
I
want to do it. But that's not how it is. You know, people like Lionel Messi have been practicing their entire life to get the ball, to get that. You need to go beat them. And nobody wants to do it. You know, nobody wants to actually have an open capital market that would allow people to come in and out with enormous amounts of money into their capital market. Nobody wants to have a responsible monetary policy. If you do that, you know, you lift the trophy. If you know, just build a larger, more open capital market and have a more responsible monetary policy than the U.S., which is becoming a lower and lower bar to clear every day. I mean, it's getting easier to beat the U.S. in monetary responsibility and open capital. Well, open capital markets, to be fair, has remained open more or less. I mean, you could argue the bailouts 2008, 2009, and 2020 was, but still, largely.
It rescued the world, though, right? It rescued the world. I mean, it was created in America, but it also rescued the world. And that's the reality. Because who were the biggest buyers of some of this structured product on subprime mortgage debt? Were European insurance companies that were playing an arbitrage game on subprime mortgage debt in the United States, getting faulty or false AAA ratings on their structured product, when in fact the true rating should have been much closer to single B or even triple C. So they were gaining a 300 basis point return and assuming they were getting zero risk. It all came home to roost. And so if you had, if the US system had defaulted, the collateral of damage would have been the entire European banking system, insurance system would have defaulted as well, or unraveled as well. So yeah, made in USA problem, but the buyers were global. And that's global capital markets set in the United States of America.
Yeah, but I mean, like, let's be realistic, though. The real people that get bailed out are actually the
creditors
and the financial institutions that are benefiting from this. So if you actually didn't bail them out, we would have had massive deflation. And so prices would have gone down.
Oh, there's no question. No question. But it would have gone everywhere. What I was trying to point out, and for people that understood, the highest levels of the risk were sold to, when I say highest level, the lowest risk, the highest credit quality were sold to European insurance companies. The bottom part of the structure were held on the balance sheets of the banks that initiated these structured products. So that's why Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns got in so much trouble, because they held the residual or tail exposure of these structured products. And those were the ones that were highest risk and unraveled to zero. And those are the ones that the Fed had to rescue. The highest echelon fell in price, but they didn't actually default in many cases. The highest echelon fell in price, but then recovered back to par. And that's what you have to understand, the difference between pricing and default risk. And, you know, we've covered a lot in this podcast. And if there's one thing that I hope to leave your viewers with, okay, and this is so important, is the transition in credit markets or treasury markets now from an inflation concern to a credit quality concern, Saif. That is the key. And even though inflation concerns can decline or inflation risks can decline, I believe that credit quality concerns will rise and there be a wash. I don't see a time when interest rates in the USA get down to historical lows like the 0.56% on 10-year US Treasuries. I think that any decrease in inflation will be met with an increase in the credit quality concerns as reflected in the credit default swap markets of sovereign debt nations. And one final sort of little shout out for the portfolio or the paper that I wrote and measured the intrinsic value of Bitcoin based on credit default swap markets of global sovereign debt. The NakamotoPortfolio.com actually has a tab where you can go in and get the intrinsic value of Bitcoin based on those open CDS markets, five-year swap markets, and you can actually create your own CDS curves and everything like that, credit default swap spread curves for a given nation. The point is this, Bitcoin is stupid cheap when measured as default insurance on global sovereign debt. By my calculation, Bitcoin on that metric should be trading at least $400,000 per Bitcoin. And it's trading under 30, you know, under 40,000. It's trading at less than 1/10 of its intrinsic value. And that intrinsic value will only increase as more people replace inflation concerns with credit quality concerns. So the intrinsic value of Bitcoin is only going to increase as credit quality concerns increase in sovereign debt nations. Bitcoin's beautiful. Once again, it's a long volatility asset. You're short credit because you own insurance on credit means you're long volatility. What used to be that product, Safe? Used to be US Treasuries. Not anymore. Now it's Bitcoin, baby.
And there's a new boss in town.
That's the thing that it takes a long time. The penny will drop. It just takes an awful long time because even you see guys like our friend Tone Vase, who insists that Bitcoin is a risk asset and it trades as and should be correlated with the S&P 500. I think that narrative will change where there will be times when the S&P 500 is going down fast and the price of Bitcoin is going up fast because, again, S&P 500 is a short volatility asset and Bitcoin truly is a long volatility asset. Takes time to educate the world and for the mathematicians to catch up. But I think that day is coming.
Yeah, and that day draws near every time bonds continue to do what they've been doing recently. And
even more so, watch credit default swap spreads. That's your big indicator, not yields, not inflation expectations in yields, credit default swap spreads on sovereign debt. That is your indicator.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I know your time is up, Greg. I really appreciate you coming on. I appreciate all the...
I love talking to you, my friend. I seriously do. You're a very deep thinker. And you know what? I've spent 30 years in bond markets. It doesn't come easy. Like it, you know, there's a huge learning curve, even though you're supposed to learn about it in school. Until you're sitting in what I call the risk chair, managing fixed income portfolios, you can't imagine what it's like. And then I flippantly say stuff that people are supposed to appreciate. No, because they've never sat in that risk chair. The only guys that understand really what I'm saying are other guys that have worked on trading desks or fixed income trading desks, whether you're on the buy side, like insurance.